you can meet and hear Hank Hanegraaff, Hans Feeney, Scott Klusendorf, Craig Parton, Will Wheaton, Angus Manoogian, and Jonathan Fisk at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Collinsville is 15 miles east of St. Louis. Early bird registration is $110. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 8th and 9th in Collinsville, Illinois.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. There's no doubt that the sexual revolution, especially in the last 20 years, has accelerated, gone into overdrive. Is further acceleration the only possible future here? Is it possible that, say, the early popularity of something like same-sex marriage might not be the trend for the future, but in fact simply just a momentary indicator? Is it possible that the way we have redesigned the way, and in some ways technologically redesigned the way that men and women meet one another, what they expect of one another, and especially what happens when they encounter one another sexually, are there babies in the picture or not, has permanently changed at least a generation of people and their ability, if not their willingness, to marry and have ordinary, committed, lasting relationships. We're going to begin a conversation on men, women, and the mating market. Dr. Mark Regnerus joins us. He's a regular guest, associate professor of sociology at the University of Texas, Austin. His research is in the areas of sexual behavior, family, marriage, and religion. He's author of several books, including his latest, Cheap Sex, The Transformation of Men, Marriage, and Monogamy. Dr. Regnerus, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
You likened the cheapening of sex to the decline of locally owned boutique shops and the rise of a big box discount chain. What do you mean by that retail analogy?
Right. Well, one of the things I talk about in the book is how sort of the price of sex has come way down, such that it reminds me of sort of the mass production of goods, and so that more people can access those goods cheaper, just like that, what happened to sort of the higher priced local stores, mom and pop stores, in the wake of sort of the advent of the big box stores, where there's more of everything, it's cheaper, more, you know, it's more democratic in that everybody can get access to it. So I say this about sex because the price of sex has definitely gone down, and I attribute that to several different technologies that we can get into, but the price of access to men accessing sex has dropped significantly in the last probably four decades. So it reminds me of sort of the same kind of rush to get cheaper goods in higher quantity and then arguably less quality, frankly.
So you say that the cheapening of sex has been facilitated by three factors. You named them early in the book. Let's take them just one at a time briefly, and that is the uptake of the pill, as well as a mentality stemming that sex is naturally infertile. How is that facilitated?
Right. Well, the one follows the other, right? So we really have a hard time, I think, thinking thoughts pre-pill today. I mean, it was such a profound shift in relationships between men and women. Prior to this time, I talk about and I sort of display a graph of the mating pool, right? Like where everybody was in it and people would be looking for company of some sort. But you know, prior to the 60s and probably even earlier in the 20s, 30s, 40s, everybody was sort of in the same pool. But once the pill kind of, not just it hits, but you know, it takes a decade or so to kind of work its way through the legal system, then once it sort of starts to be uptaken, there's an explosion, really, in the amount of premarital sex that starts to occur, because no longer does she say to him, or easily say to him, explicably say to him, oh, no, we can't do this, I barely know you, or the key thing being, I could get pregnant, right? I mean, the pill, far more than any condom, sort of really pulled down what we call the cost of sex to men, right? So he is able to access sex easier. She gets control of her fertility, so she doesn't get pregnant nearly so much, right? But he gets control over the pace of the relationship and when sex is added to the relationship, right? She no longer has this argument that, oh, we can't do this. I barely know you. I could get pregnant. That was, you know, for the longest time, the kind of key motivator to slow a relationship down. Now she has traded that away for fertility control. Not actively. I mean, this happened to everybody, right? So that's a key first technology. And as you said, it creates this mentality, which is very prominent today, that sex is kind of naturally infertile. I start the book out with a story about a woman who moved from New York to Austin. She's had 20-some-odd partners, which, of course, is increasingly normal, but not. It's still well above average for a man or a woman. But she's in her mid to upper 30s at this point and has never had a pregnancy scare, right? Isn't that amazing? So I make this argument in chapter 2. We now think of sex in a different way as like something that doesn't really inherently risk pregnancy, right? It doesn't mean that nobody is aware of that. Plenty of people are, you know. But I argue that the mental connection between sex and babies is really weakened by the successful uptake of the pill. So that's that first technology that we're talking about.
Another one you say is the kind of, and we have to recognize it, mass-produced pornography. It's not just an industry.
Yeah.
It is a mega industry.
Yeah, and it's not just the fact that it exists, because it does exist in cruder or more high-quality forms for quite some time. But it really is the advent of the internet, which takes it out of the back room of certain magazine shops, which most of us didn't want to be seen in, to the privacy of everybody's home and office. And not only that, but then it gets a boost with the sort of streaming content that comes, probably a decade or a little bit over a decade after it's kind of the internet got popular. So in the early 2000s, you have streaming content. Now it's not just, you know, a picture that looks like the picture that might have been in Playboy 20, 30 years ago. Now it's a film. It's bedside, and now you've got these massive monitors, video, audio. It more closely mimics the real sexual experience than ever before. So people get irritated about this, obviously, and spouses or girlfriends get irritated about husbands or boyfriends, parents about children. But what I say about it in the book is we underestimate like what this has done to how people meet and how people sort of pace relationships. So I say that this too drags down the cost of sex. And the reason that is because, and we can hear it in women's complaints, she'll say, I can't compete with this person on screen, right? And when she's making this argument, she's making an economics argument, right? Like, she can't do the same thing or offer the same thing that he can see on screen. So, well, what happens when there's competition, right? Well, the price of things goes down, right? So it's no surprise then that when I ask some pretty blunt questions about people's sexual behavior, it starts to sound like pornography, right? Their actual sexual behavior. So that's the second technology, quite distinct from the first. But that's the second technology that has lowered the cost of sex to men.
The third one that you mentioned is the advent and the evolution of online dating, or we could even call them now hookup services. What are they about?
Right. Well, it's all together, right? I mean, online dating services can be used for hookups. They don't have to be used for hookups. When we think of eHarmony, we don't think of people looking for hookups, right? But what I claim in the book, and I think the evidence and experience of people is true to form, is that the mentality of online dating fosters kind of an objectification of both men and women, but it also makes more efficient the search for a mate, whether you're searching for like a marital partner or somebody to keep company with for a few hours or overnight. I mean, it is an efficient search, right? Instead of, and I use the example in the book of me back in college in the pre-internet era, dating my wife, we have some squabbles, some arguments, and then eventually she breaks up with me and goes to the Chicago Auto Show with a mutual friend of ours, and I get a little envious and think, well, maybe our problems aren't so bad, and I go back and woo her and say, no, come back. I still want to be your boyfriend. So partly I do that because the search costs pre-internet era, pre-online dating, are kind of high. Like your pool is those around you that you come into regular contact with. With online dating, no matter how you use it, the pool is greatly expanded to people you don't know who are around you, people who you don't know who might, you know, fit your profile in a city 20 miles away, 200 miles away, 2,000 miles away. I mean, and it makes me think, you know, what would I have done back in the early 1990s when I had a problem in my relationship? If I had access to all these online dating sites, people telling you they'd like to meet you, one has to think like, oh, there are plenty of burgeoning relationships like mine was that today don't try to solve their problems when they have problems early in a relationship. They just bag it and say, ah, there are other people looking for me. Okay. So that technology, not so much, in part because it objectifies people on a handful of characteristics, doesn't portray the whole person very well. Probably even primarily because this is an efficient way of cycling through people. So those three technologies, you know, and some people make moral claims to use more than others, right? There are moral claims that people make about the pill. There's not very good moral claims that people make about pornography, but people can try. But there's plenty of moral claims that people make about online dating, right? I know good people who have met, fallen in love, and married via online dating. But I say in the book that the underlying kind of manner in which it operates, it can be utilized for good, but it can't really be reformed for good, if that makes sense.
Dr. Mark Ragnaris is our guest. We're talking about men, women, and the mating market. First part of a two-part conversation with him. He's author of several books, including his latest, Cheap Sex, The Transformation of Men, Marriage, and Monogamy. When we come back, how would he respond to the many who would say, nothing's really changed here. We're just discovering our own deep-rooted, non-monogamous natures. Stay tuned.
Scientism is not science. It's a dangerous and self-refuting philosophy that fixates on means but ignores wisdom.
Dr. Angus Manoj of the Evangelical Philosophical Society talking about his presentation at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And it leads to the abolition of man as man is reduced to a material object. It's used as a weapon by atheists and skeptics to attack religion as a source of knowledge. It begins with Bacon's dictum, knowledge is power, but it overlooks the way in which power corrupts.
You can meet and hear Dr. Angus Manoj making the case against scientism at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th, 15 miles east of St. Louis in Collinsville, Illinois. You'll find a list of speakers, topics, and registration information at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 8th and 9th in Collinsville, Illinois.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Things when I hear on the radio tonight about Obama being a Christian but not being good because of his pro-choice and homosexuality stances.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Yet I see no evidence of any literature that in the Bible that you stated that says that these things are against biblical teachings.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
We are less than 3 months away from the premier conference for Christian laity, the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. We are more than half full, so don't wait to register. You can watch a live broadcast, worship, participate in hymn sing, and meet and hear Will Whedon, Scott Klusendorf, Hans Feeney, Jonathan Fisk, Hank Hanegraaff, and Angus Manoj. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th, 15 miles from downtown St. Louis. It's part one of a two-part conversation on men, women, and the mating market. Dr. Mark Regneris is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Texas, Austin. His research is in areas of sexual behavior, family, marriage, and religion. Dr. Regneris, how would you respond to someone who says, look, nothing's really changed here. This is just modern and postmodern society coming to grips with our own deep-rooted, non-monogamous natures?
Yeah, I hear that one with some regularity. I'm willing to grant that people over human history, especially men, but maybe even women, have been interested in more than one relationship in their life. I don't think that's terribly shocking. But the funny thing is that some of the claims are that, oh, we're just rediscovering this nature of ours. I'm like, well, we wouldn't have rediscovered this nature of ours had it not been for this, rapid decline in the cost of sex, because non-monogamy kind of can only work if nobody's getting pregnant. So I have a piece coming out in Public Discourse either later this week or next week on polyamory, and it really is kind of a humorous how it's proponents claim it as an identity, claim it as being sort of egalitarian, things like that. And I'm thinking, there's very little egalitarian about it. It's not an identity, it's a behavior. And frankly, it only works because we now have separated sex from babies pretty effectively, right? I mean, think about a non-monogamous relationship. They're typically saturated with jealousy. That it may come and go, but I mean, it's never very far away, jealousy. But what happens when somebody with a secondary partner, not their primary partner, if you want to put it that terms, gets pregnant by their secondary partner? Do you think the primary partner is going to be very happy about that? I don't think so, right? So this only works because we can end pregnancies or prevent them to begin with. And that is largely and become good at doing that in the past several decades. So I think all this nonsense about our primal natures is more about like, well, this is the way people want to access more sex partners, and justify it historically, anthropologically. Well, I think the primary reason we can even go in that direction is because the success of technology, which is decidedly new and modern and has nothing to do with ancient humankind.
What is confluent love?
confluent love. It's actually a term that I talk about that Anthony Giddens, who's a British social theorist, probably the most famous sociologist alive today, said nice things about my book on the back cover of it. Partly my book was about what he predicted 25 years ago would emerge. And one of the things he predicted would emerge was this idea of confluent love. Confluent meaning it comes, it goes, it's flexible, and it only endures so long as the two people, the key units here, wish for it to endure. So that's the mentality. And frankly, we see more of that today. It's not necessarily the dominant frame just yet, but it's certainly on its way to becoming so. I associate it, as does Anthony Giddens, with this idea of the pure relationship, which has nothing to do with religious or Christian purity. But he talks about you're in the relationship purely because you want to be in this relationship. But I think about, like, my marriage. It's approaching 25 years. 3 children. I mean, they are invested in this relationship too, right? Not just about me. So it's no longer confluent. I'm no longer free to just sort of waltz in and out of it as I wish, because a lot more is at stake. But Giddens, and I think the evidence points in his direction today, he said a quarter of a century ago, and we're seeing it today, that people are approaching relationships, whether they have children or not in those relationships, as sort of, this thing lasts as long as you and I want it to, and no more.
What do you mean by the mating market?
Yeah, well, that is a thing that exists. People don't really probably like to talk about it, but, take, for example, me. I've been married 24 and a half years. I've been off the mating market for a very long time. But people who aren't married, or people who have been married and gotten a divorce or become widowed, you know, and the entire pool of young people, so to speak, are kind of in a mating pool. They're eligible for a relationship, right? And frankly, people who are trying to do this non-monogamy thing are kind of see themselves both as married and in the dating pool, which is ridiculous. But the mating market is simply this kind of idea that there's a structure out there that organizes how people meet and what they do. I mean, people can't just do whatever they want with whomever they want. I mean, there are strong norms, there's rules, there's laws about these things. You can kind of see it, a glimpse of it in this kind of pushback against relationships in the workplace today, right? People are nervous about that. You know, there's differences in power. We see that in the Me Too hashtag movement. So there's pushback against dating within the workplace, even though the workplace has long been a source of overlap where people meet in this sort of the mating market. But now, post-pill area, the mating market did something unique. It was split into two, so that people who are in the mating pool, and there's always been what we call CADs, men who don't really want to commit. There's been men who are interested in committing. Women tend, on average, to want to commit sooner or want a relationship to serve a purpose of marriage, the goal of marriage. But once the sort of the price of sex plummets, especially with the pill, but it's augmented and boosted by both pornography and online dating, you've got a split mating market, one corner of which is for people who are interested in short-term relationships, and the other corner, people who are interested in marrying, right? And in the middle is this sort of big, muddy, some level of commitment, but not complete commitment, okay? So, but men and women are not sort of randomly organized in this mating market. Men will veer towards the short-term relationship market, right? This is why, you know, in bars, men try to pick up women. And you see it, and you hear this lament in churches, like, oh, there's no good men out there, because we know that women, on average, are sort of want relationships to serve the goal of marriage, more clearly, typically so, than men. So the mating market gets split into two corners by the pill, because pregnancy is just no longer a major risk, even though it actually is. People don't realize it, but it's still a risk because a lot more people are having premarital sex than did prior to the advent of the pill. So you have this gender split in the mating market, right? More men seeking short-term relationships, more women seeking longer-term relationships. And an economic idea is like power in this situation flows to the rarer of the two sexes, right? So over in the short-term relationship corner, women have the power because there's more men seeking them than vice versa. But women don't really want to be there on average. But over in the marriage corner, men are outnumbered by women so that they can be picky in the marriage corner of the market. Women can complain that they don't, that men aren't interested in committing, etc. And women wind up competing with each other for men's attentions. So that's kind of, in general, the outline of the modern mating market that has been split by a contraception pill and online dating, such that, you know, the price of sex is lowered and men are more likely to get what they want in the mating market experience than women are. So it frustrates women who will complain about lack of commitment, although I don't think men have a problem committing. It's just they don't have to commit. So we've got this split mating pool, which is different than, you know, back in, say, 100 years ago, where most people married and you kind of matched along attractiveness to the, you know, a good work ethic and some skill set and means to take care of a person. People just sort of matched, and they typically matched by their mid-20s. And now we're seeing, you know, the mating market really in a tizzy of sorts, people waiting well past their fertile years despite their wishes. I mean, the market is not efficiently moving people off, right? I mean, people get in the mating market to get off the market historically, and now people are recycling and recycling and confusing each other. It's a complex situation.
One of the things that I found fascinating in that vein is, if the numbers are to be believed, it sounds like women, when married and contemplating divorce, are more anxious to get out of marriage than men are. What did you find there?
Right. Well, they have more to lose in a bad marriage than men do. I mean, men typically like their relationships better than women in general once they're in one. Just, you know, somewhat of a economic and historical curiosity. But if women have sort of settled, so to speak, and we always talk about women settling, we don't talk about men settling because men don't really settle. So if women have settled and then realize, oh, I don't like this person I'm with, or, you know, they don't make as much money as I thought they were going to make, it's usually not like that. But, like, women are more likely to be dissatisfied with who they married than men. And the concern there is that women will strike a bad deal. I don't know if they'll call it that. And they'll want out. So roughly two-thirds of divorces are preferred by women today, right? Not because the men are all bad or much worse than women are. It's that to women, I think, being unmarried is better than being in a mediocre marriage. Whereas that's less true for men. Men, once in, and sometimes it takes them a little while, but once in, tend to be okay with a mediocre marriage than women are. So it's that too is an interesting economic phenomenon that an economist from Denver pointed out in First Things several years ago.
Dr. Mark Regneris is Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Texas, Austin. His research is in the areas of sexual behavior, family, marriage, and religion. He's author of several books, including his latest, Cheap Sex, The Transformation of Men, Marriage, and Monogamy. When you purchase Cheap Sex using the Amazon link at our website, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Listen on Demand, and look for Cheap Sex by Dr. Mark Regneris. Dr. Regneris, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Happy to do it.
Dr. Regnerus will be back tomorrow on Issues Etc. We'll find out his predictions for the next 10 years of the sexual revolution, among them that sex is going to get cheaper, that same-sex marriage probably is just going to hit its peak and then even off, and that men's sexuality along with women's become more malleable. We'll also get Megan Allman's reaction to a column in the New York Times titled How to Talk About Abortion. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.